all for coming out here tonight. I'm really excited to be here and just to share with you a little bit of the research that I've been doing for the last several years. As Sarah said, I did my master's in gastronomy at Boston University, which is just a fancy word for food studies. I focused on commensality, which is the social dynamics of eating together. And I looked specifically at how the social theories on commensality might inform our understandings of Eucharistic theology. So I'm really excited to share kind of the findings that that has born, and then also a little bit about the research that I'm doing for my book as well. So to start us out, I actually want to tell you all a story. It's a story that you've probably heard before. Most of you maybe have heard it from the time that you were born. But I hope that this telling slightly gets you to think about it in a slightly different manner. So, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God, the great gardener, crafted life out of nothing. On the third day, after separating light and dark, earth and sky, he began to form physical matter, beginning with soil. Adama, in Hebrew, the dry ground out of which sprung trees and plants and seed-bearing fruits that could carry on the cycle of life. God filled the earth and the seas with all kinds of creatures, big and small, and he called all of it good. Then God said, "Let's craft one more thing, a creature in our triune image." So he picked up a handful of the lush Adama, and he breathed into it the breath of life, and behold, God created the Adam, Hebrew for human being, and God called them very good. The world functioned in beautiful interdependence. The seed-bearing fruit, the animals, the humans would fill the earth with new life. There was only one task to which the Adam were told to attend. Govern the earth out of which you were made. Rest in the beautiful interdependence of the creation that God called very good. Find delight as you feast in the life that abounds all around. Two trees stood together in the middle of the garden where the Adam lived. The tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Just as God had given the Adam only one responsibility, God gave them only one restriction as well. A restriction on what they could eat. God told them, feast upon the fruits from hundreds of trees, just stay away from one, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But temptation proved too great, and so they plucked and they ate. They took the vegetation that was intended to sustain and to be sustained by them, and they used it to fulfill their own selfish desires. Immediately their eyes were opened. Everything that God created and called good, they realized, could be wielded for evil as well. In just one quick meal, all the relationships that God designed as good, the Adam's relationship with their bodies, with the ground, with one another, and ultimately with God, became relationships covered in shame. Their selfish desires disrupted the delicate interdependence that allowed for the flourishing of all creation. With juice still dripping down her fingers, the woman looked down at her naked body. Rather than behold the beauty of her curves or the ability for her belly to bring forth new life, she saw the dimples of her thighs and the softness of her middle. She felt shame at the nakedness that she'd only ever known as beauty, and she looked to the vegetation around her to cover up. If they eat of the tree of life, God knew, the Adam would live forever. But God could not let his precious creation live forever in this broken and hurting state. No death would be necessary to bring about new life. So he banished them from the garden. With the cycle of flourishing broken apart, the joy of new life, whether out of the ground or out of the woman's body, required sweat and tears and pain. Even the soil itself could not bring forth new life without making compost out of death. But God longed to dwell once again in his creation, the material and tastable manifestation of his love. And so God took on the broken and aching bodily form that he so carefully made and intended only for good. God looked tenderly on a woman named Mary and breathed into her belly the breath of life. And behold, a new Adam, Jesus, the embodiment of God as man. Jesus lived God's love for creation through a ministry of meals, dining with society's most marginalized, turning water into the finest of wine, 5 loaves and 2 fish into a meal for a crowd of thousands, extending forgiveness to Peter in an offering of fish, and making himself known through the breaking of bread to his disciples on the path to Emmaus. Jesus reconciled all the relationships that were broken by the knowledge of evil, relationships of humans to the ground, relationships of human community, relationships of humans to their own bodies, and ultimately, the relationship of all of creation back to God. One small meal had brought death into the world, and so Jesus took the darkest symbol of injustice and torture and reclaimed it as a sign of the continuation of life, making compost out of a cross. As you feast together, he told his followers, don't dwell on the meal that brought with it death. Feast and remember this bread and this wine, my body and my blood, this death that brings the world back to life. Remember the interconnectedness of all of creation. Remember God's desire for his beloved, tastable world to flourish all together. And remember that soon the fully triune God will dwell here once again, restoring the beautiful interconnectedness of life, where there will be no more death and no more mourning. In the closing scenes of Revelation, the garden reappears. But standing at the center, there is only one tree, the tree of life, a tree whose leaves can heal nations and that bears its fruit all year round. The option of evil is no longer to be found. The curse that was brought on by the Adam's fateful bite is forever reversed and interdependence is once again restored. The Adam and all of creation dwelling, delighting together, feasting forever in the presence of God. Food is central to the story of the gospel. From the garden to the stove to the dining room table, God uses food as both a metaphor and a means of restoring creation and establishing the kingdom of God on earth. I want to talk with you all tonight about the ways that food can teach us about both the goodness and the brokenness of creation, and how food is evidence that God is at work establishing his renewed kingdom here on earth. We're going to start tonight by developing a theology of food and eating. We'll examine how a robust understanding of meals in Scripture can inform our relationships with food. Then we'll look at the ways that food reinforces the brokenness of 3 different kinds of relationship: humanity's relationship to the ground, humanity's relationship with one another, and humanity's relationship to our own bodies. And we're going to look at why, as Christians, we are called to work against this brokenness, using food as a tool for restoration instead. Finally, we'll look at a handful of different communities that are applying this embodied theology in order to see some examples of how this reconciliation can work. So my goal tonight is that you'll walk away with a deeper understanding of how food can simultaneously tell the world the story of the gospel, how it can serve as a way to commune with God, and how it can help us fulfill our call to live as faithful caretakers of creation. Now, just a little bit of forewarning, here's something that I'm not going to do. I'm not going to offer you a prescription for the best way to eat. I'm not going to suggest any guidelines for ethical eating or ethical farming or ethical food distribution. The food system is incredibly nuanced, and there is, frankly, not an easy fix. I hope instead to offer you a theological framework for why you should care about what and how you eat, but I think it's up to you to do your own reading and research and discerning how you can most ethically operate within the food system. This will depend on your geographic limitations, your socioeconomic limitations, your cultural background, your personal relationship with food, a variety of different factors that will determine how you choose to eat. I've given you a list of resources, and I'll offer, I think, a few more at the end so that you can do some research on your own. But what I don't want is for you to walk away from this lecture tonight thinking that you must plant your own garden, or you must buy only from a farmer's market, or you must cut out processed foods entirely from your diet in order for your eating to glorify God. Instead, what I do want is for you to leave with new eyes for the importance of food and the gospel story. It's my hope that this will breathe new life into your understanding of God and will cause you to look at every meal as a chance to commune both with him and with the world that he's created. So, to get started, a theology of food and eating. The gospel is a story of meals. It's a story of a meal that brought destruction and a meal that brings new life. Why a meal? Why food? Why would God use eating as the main player in this entire narrative arc of history? I think that the theologian Norman Wiersbe says it best in his book, Food and Faith. He says, "We don't really understand food until we perceive, receive, and taste it in terms of its origin and end in God as the one who provides for, communes with, and ultimately reconciles creation. Created life is God's love made tastable and given for the good of another. The mundane act of eating is thus a daily invitation to move responsibly and gratefully within this given life. It is a summons to commune with the divine life that is presupposed and made manifest in every bite." All of creation is a physical manifestation of God's love. All of creation exists solely because God desired a world full of delight. God created humans and animals with a need to draw nutrition and energy from food in order to sustain life. And God created human beings with a need for other people. The only thing that was not good about creation was a human being alone. And because the purpose of this whole world is delight, God created the world in such a way that our most basic needs are fulfilled in the joyous act of commensality, the act of eating together as a group. Food is not just a collection of nutrients. Every single bite of food is a full sensory experience. Our experience of flavor is a combination of sight, of smell, of sound, of touch, and last of all, of taste. But not only is food a sensory experience for each of us individually, it's an experience that draws us together as a community. When we eat, we experience the delight of the created order. We experience the sensory magnificence of our human bodies. We commune with one another, and through this connection with all of creation, we commune with our Creator as well. Eating with others is a deeply intimate occasion. To share in this sensual process invites others to experience pleasure with us. It requires the sharing of our time and of our personal resources. It reveals our taste preferences, our table manners, our cooking skills, or our lack thereof. It creates the space to know one another in a deep and a different way than conversation alone can ever allow. Part of God's desire for the world is that we would derive delight out of our interconnectedness with one another. Soil feeds plants, which feed humans and animals. Humans care for and tend the soil out of which they were created. And all of creation relies on the Creator to bring forth this continuation of life so that this great communion can carry on. From the intimacy and the physical pleasure of eating, to the vulnerability of interdependence, all of creation points toward the delight of communion all together with God. What the Creator knew that the rest of creation did not was that all of these things that God created and designed as good could also be used for evil as well. Obviously, theologians have debated forever why God would allow the option of evil. So for the sake of this narrative tonight, we're going to say that without the knowledge of evil, humanity could never grasp the depth of this good world, of God's love. So God gave them an option. He created a tree whose fruit would open the eyes of humanity to the depth of evil that would prevail if this interconnectedness were ever broken. Sure enough, these humans decided that they wanted to know. They wanted their eyes open to the mysterious evil that they couldn't possibly comprehend. And so they ate the one thing that they were supposed to avoid. And at once, the four relationships that were brought into communion through the act of eating were broken. Humanity's relationship with the ground or with created life. Humanity's relationships with one another. Humanity's relationship with our own body. And as a result of all of these broken physical relationships within creation, humanity's separation from their creator as well. The Adam realized that all of creation, which God intended for good, could also be used for evil. The interdependence that God created was not only disrupted, it now works against itself instead. Life can only come into the world through pain, whether giving birth to a child or drawing vegetation from the ground. And all of life must return back to the ground in death. In this disrupted state, the ground grasps for power over humanity, men grasp for power over women, and the cycles of brokenness continue on and on and on. Since these relationships were all brought together through food, it's no surprise then that all of these areas of brokenness continue to be affected by our relationships with food as well. Both in this gospel story and throughout all of history, food has been a method of reinforcing and deepening the brokenness of creation. Now, it's important to note that although the world is broken, it still remains the good and the tasteable world that God created and that God desperately loves. The knowledge of good and evil does not mean that the goodness of the world ceases to exist. It means that these relationships that were designed to be good and designed to support one another don't function smoothly anymore. So even as we try to fix and improve each of these different places of brokenness, we face some other issue that ends up perpetuating another kind of brokenness as well. It's really tempting in studying food systems to become a Luddite, to imagine some kind of sweet and nostalgic past where everyone had a close relationship with the sources of their food. It's tempting to blame the industrial food system for all of the ills of the world right now. And it's tempting to imagine that if we went back to some perceived way of the past, that we would reverse the issues that exist. But the truth is, it's not that simple. Humanity has been fighting with the ground and with our own bodies and with one another since the very story of our creation and fall. We've been trying for all of history to function within a good but broken world. I want you to bear this tension in mind as we look a little bit closer at the injustice that is perpetuated through each of these relationships of humanity to their food. So humanity's relationship with the ground. Most folks who are concerned about healing the food system look primarily to this relationship, so I think it's the best place for us to start. Our industrial food system was developed in response to the difficulties of agrarian life. It's an example of how we've tried to learn how to function in a good but broken world. Farming and gardening are beautiful ways for humans to commune with God and with creation, but it's also incredibly hard work physically, and it's also very unpredictable. Ultimately, the weather determines whether or not we eat, so it's no wonder that throughout all of history, people have seen the weather itself as God. Because of modern technology, we're able to produce significantly more food than we've ever been able to before. Most of us in here aren't reliant on our ability to grow and forage and hunt food for ourselves in order to be able to live. And while the crops are still, of course, subject to weather patterns, our global networks mean that many of us, especially those of us in this room, are not as directly dependent on the weather in order to be able to eat. These are all good and beautiful things. But at the same time, this technology separates us further and further from creation as well. As the technologies that have allowed for this massive industrial food system have decreased our need to be individually connected to the land, we move further and further and further away from understanding how connected we are to the health of the gardens and fields and forests and animals around us. We survive off of food and energy that are harvested in manners that erode the soil, then pump it back up with fertilizers and herbicides, that poisons rivers and streams, that fells forests. We rely on coal that's harvested by exploding mountaintops. We rely on oil that emits methane and carbon dioxide gas. In our attempts to grasp for power over the earth, we move further and further away from the interdependence for which the world was designed, and we rely more and more on the depletion of its resources. I began writing this lecture just a few days after the president announced that he was pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And I'm not going to discuss whether or not that was a helpful decision, but what instead I want to point to is the response of a few prominent Christian leaders. There were a few different leaders who made statements that caring about the climate or about the environment isn't the responsibility of Christians. Our primary responsibility, they said, is to save souls. But when we look at the story of Genesis, we see that it was the Adam's selfish use of creation that led to our separation from God in the first place. God created the world to function interdependently so that everyone and everything could flourish together. The great mistake of the Adam was that rather than govern creation and maintain this interdependence, he exploited his power. He refused to honor the limitations that God put into place, which were meant to protect this interconnectedness, and instead he set creation on a trajectory of death. In his book Soil and Sacrament, the farmer and theologian Fred Bahnsen writes of the continued degradation that occurs when we treat land as nothing more than a natural resource for our consumption. Land, he says, is a living entity worthy of our deference and servitude, our watchfulness, and our best attempts at preservation. Many farmers and gardeners act as though they must find good soil before they can plant, he says, treating the soil as nothing more than the vessel in which their chemically fed crops can grow. But God created the world for interdependence, and Bahnsen has found that the wisest farmers pay attention to preserving this created order of things. Wise farmers seek to grow healthy soil. They trust that well-tended ground will birth an abundant harvest, and then they can stand back and, as Bahnsen sees it, watch God's mystery unfold. As long as we understand the ground and the rest of creation as a natural resource that's available to feed our own desires, we will continue striving for power over the earth. We will continue to tell it what we want it to produce and when, rather than looking to the cycles that God has set into place. We will continue to reinforce the brokenness of creation. We will continue to ignore our very first calling as human beings, and we will continue to ignore the importance of interdependence. And as a result, all of creation groans and aches. So the brokenness of humanity's relationship with the ground leads directly into revealing the oppressive power dynamics that encapsulate the brokenness of human relationships between one another. The global food system reveals steep imbalances of power that exist all around our world and have existed all throughout history. We see this today here in the United States through the injustice of food distribution. Here in the States, we import gross amounts of produce from around the world while using most of our own farmland to grow cheap corn, wheat, and soy that's subsidized by the government, which drives down the global prices of heirloom corn and wheat varieties and in turn destroys the livelihoods of farmers in nearby countries whose crops aren't subsidized by the U.S. government. Our desire to have cheap food encourages the exploitation of farm and restaurant workers. Oftentimes, workers who've moved to the United States because their own family farms have lost their profitability because of the prices across the United States. We poison and underpay farmers here in the United States who work with chemical fertilizers to improve our crop yields. Our entire system is predicated on exploiting the hard physical labor of immigrants, preying on the fear of deportation, or of family starvation in order to force workers to carry on despite unjust wages and unsafe working conditions. Because our food here is so cheap, we lose appreciation for its value, throwing away 40% of what we produce. And yet, while access to this food is so easy that we can thoughtlessly throw it away for those of us who live close to a grocery store or who have access to a car, 23 million Americans, 23 people in the United States live in food deserts, which are low-income areas where grocery stores don't find it profitable enough to exist. So residents are then forced to rely on corner stores and quick marts, selling mostly packaged foods rather than having any access to fresh fruits or vegetables. Beyond just those who live in food deserts, 42.2 million Americans are food insecure, which means they don't know where their next meal will come from. Food insecurity is a much harder to spot sign of poverty than, say, homelessness. I would venture to guess that all of you have food insecure folks in your schools or your church communities or in your neighborhoods, and you probably have no idea the struggle your neighbors experience. Most often, these are elderly folks without family to care for them, or they're mentally ill, or they're single parents who work full-time, but their entire food budget is eaten up by the cost of childcare. These are folks who have homes and have jobs, but one small unexpected expense will break down all of their careful budgeting. These are kids whose parents can't provide them three meals a day, and so they're completely reliant on their school lunches, and when summer comes around, they don't know what they're going to eat. These are folks who I've known that have come to me crying when their electric bill is $14 more than expected because they don't know what they'll be able to eat that week. The disparities between food that is produced, food that is wasted, and folks who are food insecure is not only an issue here in the United States, of course. Around the world, famine grips at this time Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen. In some areas, like Somalia, the famine is due to droughts that are directly related to climate change. In other areas, like Yemen, it's due to war and to cuts in foreign food aid. As we discussed when talking about our relationship with the ground, new farming technologies are being developed in order to address the limitations of farming. These new technologies desperately hope to fix these disparities and feed the world. But at the same time, these new technologies also unintentionally reinforce dynamics of power. They leave farmers in developing countries dependent on the business interests of the companies that develop this new technology in the first place. Imbalanced power breeds hunger. Hunger breeds violence. Violence breeds more hunger. And the cycles of brokenness continue on and on and on. But of course, these injustices aren't just the result of an industrial food system. Slavery and colonialism helped us get to where we are today, too, as for those of us with European ancestors, our ancestors dominated the world with a desire for coffee, tea, sugar, chocolate, and tobacco in massive quantities without thought as to whose bodies or whose families or whose cultures got destroyed in the process. The practice of sharecropping deepened the pain and left traumatic scars that continue to affect relationships between people and farming in communities of color here in the United States. And as deep as this brokenness between humanity is through the production of and access to food, the brokenness of our relationships to one another are not only rampant in the fields and in the grocery stores. Remember that the purpose of eating was that it brought into full communion our relationships with the ground, with one another, with our bodies, and with God. So it's no surprise that these dynamics of power are played out at dining room tables as well. As we talked about earlier, eating together is an intimate act, which means that when it's done thoughtfully, it can build powerful community. But the same vulnerability that can pull people together can be a powerful source of division as well. When tables or meals are not intentionally focused on promoting equality, they more likely create boundaries based on age or gender or social standing. Of course, all of these divisions are not necessarily bad. Separating parents and children at the Christmas dinner can be a really great experience for kids to have fun conversation and parents to get some respite from child conversation. But it's the same tendency, the same dynamics that push us to divide that can have really harmful effects. And when we don't intentionally think about if our tables are pulling people together, are making everyone feel welcome, and giving everyone the space to engage, then they are almost certainly being used to divide instead. The early Christians that gathered together in the city of Corinth hosted a very divisive table. Rather than sharing their meal altogether, which was meant to break down the stratification of social status, the Corinthians ate their meals separately. They didn't think about how their eating affected the entire community together. One member would go hungry and another would get drunk. The Apostle Paul chastises them for their use of the meal, which was intended as a sign of God's abundance and was instead being used to separate the rich and the poor. "When you eat this way," Paul tells them, "it is not Jesus' supper that you eat. You eat and drink judgment when you humiliate the poor in your community." The church in Corinth was not unique in their eating habits. Throughout all of history, the table has been used to divide people based on social class. But as followers of Christ, the Corinthian church and all Christians after them are supposed to do the opposite. We're supposed to be breaking down this stratification. Jesus' ministry of meals was so powerful and so controversial because by inviting the most rejected members of society to sit at his table, he was flipping all expectations of power. He was looking at those who were viewed as dirty and as inconvenient, and he called them very good. Who do you invite to sit at your table? Or more importantly, who's getting left out of your table that you don't even realize? So when we're talking about all of the ills of the food system, most food activists stop here. The brokenness obviously is already deeply apparent, and the process of healing this brokenness already seems impossible. So really, why do we need to go on any further? But as Christians, we can't stop here. We cannot fully understand the depth of brokenness, but neither can we fully understand the beauty of our own relationship to food if we do not also look at the relationships of ourselves to our own human bodies in the context of a broken food system. In Western Christianity, we really don't like to talk about the tensions of this relationship. We here in the West have a tendency of being very Gnostic in our Christian practice. We don't like the messiness of seeing our bodies as wholly good and also broken and also interdependent with the rest of creation. We aren't good at both delighting in what God has called good and also honoring the limitations that are necessary to maintain the interdependence that God created us for. Some Christians go to the extreme of seeing our bodies as inherently bad. They see the world as unimportant at best and as dangerous at worst. And then, therefore, they see the cravings of our bodies for food and for sex as meaningless at best and as dangerous at worst. Others go to the opposite extreme. They see that God called our bodies good, and they ignore that we were also created to function in interdependence within a whole system of creation. We were created to delight in the world that God made, but because this whole balance of creation is upset, we cannot trust that what our body craves is always what is best for us or for the world around us. This Gnostic view of our body tends to push us in one of two directions. Either it pushes us to seek harsh control over our bodies. It pushes us to place a moral value on the appearance of our bodies as almost evidence of the stringency of our self-control, which then becomes a moral or even a theological ethic that we create. Or, on the other hand, it pushes us to completely let go of our bodies and not care for them at all. When we assign this moral value on the appearance of our bodies, we lose sight of our created purpose, which is to delight in creation. We focus our attention on our ability to control rather than on recognizing our role as created beings who are supposed to both care for and delight in creation. Anytime we let go of the importance of being created as embodied creatures in the image of God, we call unimportant or flawed what God called good. So long as our relationship with our body is one of shame, our relationship with food will always fall short of what God's desire is for us. Rather than viewing food as a way to delight in what God has made, we understand it primarily by the way it will alter our physical appearance. We order our lives around numbers and calculations rather than the enjoyment of what God has made. When we talk about things like chocolate or like ice cream, we use words like indulge and guilty pleasure. Our language tells us that we should feel guilt over pleasure. But God created us to delight, and God created us to find pleasure in the material world. We miss out on opportunities for communion with God when we try and abstain from the pleasures that God has called good. When we boil foods down to their nutritive content, we miss out on the process of delighting in the wide range of flavors that God has created. With this focus doesn't just keep us from enjoying rich foods, but oftentimes it also tends to keep us from fully appreciating or finding pleasure in well-farmed and deeply flavorful vegetables as well. We tend to lose total connection with our taste buds and our ability to delight in what is good food. At the same time, the opposite side, letting go of our bodies entirely, falls short of God's design as well. When our delight in physical pleasure leads us away from caring for the creation that God has made, we move into just as harmful a degree as total abstinence. Father Robert Farrar Capone, who is an Episcopal priest and a food writer, writes a really lovely treatise on the balance of fasting and of feasting to return us back to greater appreciation for the relationship between our bodies and food. He writes that the greatest trick of the devil is the process of desubstantialization, moving us further and further away from appreciating the materiality of anything. He says, "It is only when man or woman, by feast and fast, lays a firm grip on the fatness of the earth that he himself will return to sanity and substance. To begin with, real eating will restore his sense of the festivity of being. Food does not exist merely for the sake of its nutritional value. To see it so is only to knuckle under still further to the desubstantialization of man. To regard not what things are, but what they mean to us. To become, in short, solemn idolaters, spiritualizing what should be loved as matter. A man's daily meal ought to be an exultation over the smack of desirability which lies at the roots of creation. To break real bread is to break the loveless hold of hell upon the world, and, by just that much, to set the secular free. But second, he will, by his fasting, be delivered from the hopelessness of mere gourmandise. The secular, for all its goodness, does not defend itself very well against mindless and perpetual consumption. It cries out to be offered by abstinence as well as use, to be appreciated, not simply absorbed. The real secret of fasting is that it is a major entrance into the agony, the passion by which the incarnate word restores all things to the goodness that God finds in them. As long as humanity lives in the midst of such brokenness with all of creation, we're broken in our relationship with our Creator as well. A gospel that begins with the brokenness between humanity and God without examining the impact of the brokenness within the physical world is incomplete. It fails to grasp God's desperate love for his material creation, and it fails to understand why we are divided from God in the first place. We cannot strive to heal the brokenness of our division with God without also healing the brokenness within creation. Norman Wiersbe says in his book, Making Peace with the Land, that the reconciliation of human souls, however commendable and beautiful, would be an impoverished reconciliation if such souls were consigned to bodies that must eat, drink, and breathe their way through a poisoned and degraded creation. It's only through the healing of our relationship with God that we're able to participate in the restoration of creation. And the healing of our relationship with God is incomplete if it does not include our participation in the restoration of creation. But as we've seen, there is no easy fix for this entire broken system. It is the result of a creation that was designed for interdependence and has been broken by selfishness. To think that we can fix this system in any complete way is naive, and it ignores the very real and the very damaging effects of these broken systems and the ways that our attempts to fix them end up perpetuating further brokenness. But at the same time, as followers of Jesus, we're supposed to live our lives with the intention of bringing the kingdom of God to earth. We're supposed to live for the day that God will restore creation back to its full communion, which means we should continually be recognizing and responding to the brokenness that touches every aspect of the system. I'm an Anglican, and we Anglicans are a little bit obsessed with the season of Advent. I really love Advent and tend to talk about the lessons of Advent all year round because I think that they are always applicable. Advent's a time when we recognize the tension of the already, but the not yet. A world that is already the good creation that is beloved by God. A world where Christ has already died and risen again. a world where the restoration of creation has already been set into motion. But a world that is not yet fully restored. A world that is still deeply broken, where Christ has not yet come again. A world in which we are expectant that ultimately God will complete the work that he began. In Romans 7, Paul says, "For I do not do the good that I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing." I think that our interactions with the food system are a perfect example of this tension. The systems of injustice are so deep that even as we strive to fix one area of brokenness, we end up deepening another in some way. It is impossible for us to untangle ourselves completely from the brokenness of creation. And yet, as followers of Christ, that's exactly what we're supposed to try to do. There are times when I get so exhausted by the complexities of it all that I really question if any of it matters. I question if any of my decisions or any of my interactions with food actually have any meaning or purpose at all. I question that if nothing is going to be restored outside of Christ's return, is there any reason that I should care at all about my own role within the whole food system? I'm sure that God expected we would get exhausted with this and that we would get overwhelmed by the brokenness of everything. But here's the great beauty in it all. When we realize that all of these areas of deep brokenness are the result of a good creation that is functioning imperfectly, we realize that deep down, food is still the deeply good thing that God created and that God desperately loves. When we look closely at the process of growing and of cooking and of eating food, we see that God tells the story of redemption and resurrection through even the most mundane elements of creation. Soil brings forth new life by composting organic matter that has died. Bread brings back to life wheat that has died, which has been the core food throughout all of human civilization. Wine forms naturally out of the yeasts that are present on grapes. It extends the life of the grape and keeps it from ever dying. All of it cries out, "Behold, I am making all things new." Death does not have the final say. Death always comes with resurrection. Death always brings forth new life. The prophet Isaiah speaks of creation itself rejoicing in the coming redemption. And Jesus speaks of even the stones crying out if his disciples were to keep silent. And I don't think that these are written as some kind of crazy example of some mystical action. Every single day, the physical and touchable and edible aspects of the world tell the story of God's love and God's restoration. Every day, every aspect of food points us towards communion with one another, with our bodies, with the physical world, and ultimately back with God. Every single meal points us towards the ultimate purpose for which everything came to be, the delight of God. When we look at the story of the gospel woven into our food, then living with our hope in the restoration of creation is not some kind of metaphysical idea, some kind of spiritual retreat from the world around us. When we remember Christ's death and resurrection in the taste of bread and wine, the most basic and tactile elements of creation remind us that Christ will come again, and they provide us with the hope that our care for creation is a vital element of the kingdom of God at hand. When we heed God's initial commandment to keep and till and find joy in the earth's fruits, then we're able to use our relationships with creations as the very tools to take part in its restoration. When we look closely at the world around us, we see that God has used it to tell us again and again and again the gospel story of redemption. We refocus our attention on the very purpose for which we were made, which is to delight and to commune all together with creation and, most importantly, with our Creator. So, of course, then, Jesus commands us to remember his death and to look forward to the final restoration of all things through a meal, and most specifically, a meal of bread and wine. This is a meal that reminds us that eating is the culmination of all of the reasons for which we were made. It's a reminder of the delight for which we were created, and it's a small foretaste of the full and perfect communion of humanity to the earth, to our bodies, and to one another, and to God that will be the hallmark of the new creation. At the same time, it serves as both a reminder of and a reversal of the meal that brought destruction into the world. The commensality, the process of taking this meal together, reminds us of our need for community. The bread reminds us of our need for nourishment. And the wine elevates our meal from mere nourishment to conviviality, to joyful communion together, as a reminder that God's will is for our basest needs to be addressed in a manner that brings us delight, both in food and in one another. So, we have this theology of food, and now you're probably thinking, what do we do with this? Hopefully, you are all as overwhelmed as I am by how beautiful and intricate and detailed God is as a creator and a gardener and a storyteller and an artist. I tend to get really overwhelmed when I read or write about food, so hopefully you feel just a little bit of that as well. But you're probably still thinking, what do I do with this, and how do I let this inform my own eating and my own practice? So we've already said that I'm not going to give you any recommendations on how you personally need to eat. I would encourage all of you to go and do some further research on your own about how you can let this theology impact your personal food choices. Instead, tonight, what I want us to do is to take a look at a few different communities who are applying this embodied theology of food and eating in order to see what can happen when Christian communities are transformed by their understanding of food. So my own area of research, like I said before, is in commensality, the social dynamics of eating together. I look at how the process of eating together builds community by studying how people describe their own physical feelings. I take a social science approach to the study of the Eucharist by taking social theories of commensality and examining what it might tell us about what God intended for the meal that we take every Sunday. For early Christians, eating together was the main act of worship. There's a growing number of church communities today that are looking back to the early church to question how we might be able to use our worship to lead us into being better stewards of creation. What many of these churches have found is that by growing, cooking, and eating food together as an act of worship, they have a powerful method of building community and a powerful method of having an impact on breaking down the brokenness of the food system. Hospitality, or the sharing of meals with strangers, was a divinely inspired activity for Christ and for his followers. The people of ancient Israel understood themselves as sojourners in a foreign land who, as the people of God, held a responsibility to still care for all vulnerable strangers in their midst. Jesus himself was dependent on the hospitality of others for most of his life. Like the Israelites, he viewed himself as simultaneously a guest and a host. Throughout his sojourn here on earth, he extended hospitality to the vulnerable men and women in his midst. So when the earliest Christians gathered together after Christ's death, doing this over a meal was the natural extension of Jesus' ministry. Setting tables that were intentionally non-hierarchical and that worked against the social stratification was precisely what Jesus had spent his entire life doing. But the meals that came after Christ's death, the meals that Jesus instituted in his Last Supper, were embedded with an even deeper meaning. They were a new practice of the Passover. Every Passover celebration opened with the sacrifice of an animal, and it culminated with a meal. It was an invitation to sit with God and to receive a blessing. When Jesus offered the bread and the wine at his final Passover meal, Jesus revealed himself as the sacrificial lamb. So from that meal forward, every single time Christ's followers met to eat in remembrance of him, they understood that God was abiding with them at the table. Every single ordinary meal became holy. Acts 2 describes these early gatherings of Christians by saying they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They gave to anyone as he had need. They broke bread together in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. In its earliest form, the church was a gathering of people who simply ate together, living out this purpose for which they were made, to delight in God over a meal. The early Christian writer Tertullian offers a more detail regarding these early church meals. He describes the gatherings as places that brought together aristocrats and slaves in genuine care for one another. He says that they opened and closed every meeting in prayer, feasting together and giving money to the community proportionate to their income. Through this economic sharing, they took care of the needs of the poor and the sick. They buried their dead and they provided for the elderly. They spoke as though God was present with them, abiding at their table. They expressed a genuine love for one another that amazed those who observed it. At the time of Tertullian's writing, Roman fraternities were common places of gathering for aristocrats. These places were known for their debauchery. They were the quintessential vision of wealth and excess. In contrast, the Christian gatherings brought together the wealthy with the poor to dine as equals. They lived out a mindset of abundance, believing that when the rich and poor come together to share their resources, there is always enough for anyone that walks through the door. This connection between a full meal and the Eucharist theology was mostly lost with the rise of Constantine and the imperialization of the church. Gatherings were shifted from small circular tables of equality into a hierarchical focus on church leaders. These were highly formal events that were reflective of political and economic power. These ornate churches reflect a deep reverence for a powerful God, which is a beautiful thing. But at the same time, these services took away the radical social subversion of a meal-focused worship. The Reformation brought back much of the simplicity that Constantine had taken away, but it also emphasized a cerebral faith and linear thinking. Following Christ came to mean mentally accepting a series of doctrines rather than embodying the practice of eating together. Post-Reformation, holiness and hospitality didn't go hand in hand as well. The church valued asceticism, and so for some, feasting together was seen as antithetical to pious worship. Worship over a meal was seen by many as too joyful or too focused on physical pleasure. But even as the church moved away from holding their primary service over the course of a meal, of course, eating together has continued to remain a very important aspect of community life for many Christians for as long as any community that I've seen. Charles Wesley was inspired by the agape meals of Moravian Christians, which were communal meals that were centered on prayer and the reading of scripture. Many Wesleyan traditions continue to practice these meals, which they call love feasts, and they understand it as the valuable alternative to the Eucharist when there is not a minister present to bless the sacraments. Crockpots and casseroles and Sunday night potlucks and Wednesday night dinners, coffee hours and holiday feasts are all hallmarks of church communities of every background. The religious historian Daniel Sack says that Protestants eat before church, after church, and occasionally during church. If you ask American Protestants why they go to church, they're likely to say that they go not for the doctrine or for the ethics, but for the community. A community that is usually built and sustained around food. So the contemporary churches that I study are what I call dinner churches. They aim to reconnect the theology of the Eucharist with the practice of eating a full meal. They embody this theology of food and of eating in order to focus their community on radically breaking down different stratifications of social status, and on finding Christ's presence in even the most mundane aspects of living. By connecting with God through food, they're using their worship and they're leveraging their resources of their community to work against the systems of brokenness that touch every single aspect of food. Verlin Fosner is the pastor of a large dinner church in Seattle, and he likes to say that when Jesus established his ministry of meals, he was giving both a means and a message. The story of redemption is inextricably linked with the process of feasting together in socially and economically diverse communities. What is really remarkable about these different food-centered church communities is that when they turn the process of eating into the act of worship itself, they become perfectly poised to identify the different physical needs within their community, and their worship becomes a place to address those needs. Emily Scott is the pastor who started one of the first dinner churches here in the United States, and she has mentored dozens of other dinner church leaders since. She says that she tells everyone to look for the hunger in their community and then to model their service in a way that addresses that specific hunger. Every dinner church looks slightly different because all of them have slightly different hungers that they need to address. These are dependent on their location. These are dependent on the size of their community, on the cultural backgrounds of their community, of the different things that hurt their community. But what's consistent is that they all use the same model, and the same model gives them the ability to address specific needs in specific settings. Some of these are small churches that are focused on facilitating dialogue. So these smaller churches typically have between 10 and 30 people at every service. They're based on getting people to engage in discussion around the table. Most often, these are churches that are seen as safe spaces for people who have felt rejected by the church to bring their questions and their fears and their doubts and their concerns. These are places for people who maybe feel lonely and don't know where to find community or how to step into community. These are places where people who feel like they've been silenced are given a place to speak. And there are places where it's safe to disagree while remaining committed to the communion together, to seeing oneself as one body in the breaking of bread, even when we disagree on a million other smaller factors. So at St. Lydia's, which is the church that Emily Scott started in Brooklyn, and at Simple Church in Grafton, which is the church where I work, we start every service together standing in a circle. We start and open with the bread portion of the Eucharist. Then after that, we move to smaller dinner tables where we read scripture, we hear a sermon, and we have a time of discussion as we eat. Then after we finish discussing, we return to the large circle. So it's a very physical showing of when we're sitting at the tables, most of us disagree on a whole lot of things. And then we get back together into one big circle and we worship and we take the grape juice or the wine. So these are methods of very physically showing that we can disagree, but we're still committed to remaining one body. For some other churches, these small dialogue-based churches are seen as a place of healing for those who've been wounded by the church. Potluck Church, which is a dinner church in Madisonville, Kentucky, describes themselves as a halfway house for those who've been hurt by the church. So their goal is not to see their community as separate from a traditional church or as kind of an alternative to the traditional worship service. Instead, they see themselves as a place where people can have questions and can safely bring their doubts and their concerns and their worries, or just have a space to heal when they feel wounded by the larger church. But their goal is constantly to get people to see their connection with the larger Big C church. Some of these dinner churches are specifically focused on addressing food insecurity in a way that empowers those who are poor. One of these examples is Community Dinners, which is Verlin Fosner's church in Seattle. They host services in a different neighborhood every single night of the week. Every meal feeds between 100 and 300 people, about 85% of whom are homeless. Another example is a church called Garden Church in San Pedro, California. Garden Church worships on what was an empty plot of land in the middle of a city that is built on a hill. So at the top of the hill, you have a lot of homeowners who own really expensive homes, and at the bottom of the hill is where a lot of homeless folks gather because it's the only place that they have. And there are a few different cafes in the area that are really welcoming and supportive of the homeless folks. But for the most part, this city has been known for homeowners' deep fights with the city to try and get the homeless off the street. So at Garden Church, those who are homeless and those who own homes work together in the garden and eat together as a part of worship. Through this process, homeowners have developed deep relationships with homeless, and those homeowners have become some of the fiercest advocates for getting the homeless folks in the neighborhood the help that they need instead of getting them forced off of the streets. Both of these churches understand that Jesus spent his time on earth dwelling with the most marginalized and overlooked people of society. This wasn't just because Jesus felt a responsibility to address their needs. This is because these were the people who brought Jesus the most delight. These churches operate out of the realization that the Holy Spirit continues to dwell in the places where Jesus dwelled, among the hungry, the lonely, and the poor. They believe that when we understand that the Spirit of God is still alive and present and speaking to those who are most marginalized by society, then we can realize that it's among the hungry that we will find God as well. They seek to reverse power dynamics by dismantling the evangelistic pressure for those who are wealthy and those who are learned to instruct those who are powerless in how to believe. Instead, they see their communities as a place where a diverse community can come and eat together and seek the image of God in one another. And they trust that the Holy Spirit is the one speaking and leading them and guiding them all together into salvation as they feast together in God's presence. So finally, there are churches and ministries that do their work very directly in the soil. They try to use their worship to reconnect with the very first call of humans to keep and till the earth. Garden Church is one church that fits within this model, as is a place called Farm Church in Durham, North Carolina. These are churches that have their services in gardens and in farms. They till the earth, they garden, and they harvest together as an act of worship. They sing and they take communion in the middle of a field. These churches operate out of Fred Bahnsen's idea that if we begin by caring for the soil, then interdependence will shift its way back into place. So by digging their hands in the dirt as an act of worship, they're trying to reconnect with the ground, and in turn they're reconnecting with the agrarian themes that are woven all throughout Scripture. So obviously these are a little bit more radical methods of ordering your church community or Christian community around this theology of food. But there's plenty of other ways that communities are trying to embody this theology of eating. There are dozens of churches, probably actually hundreds of churches now, that maintain church gardens, or that host farmers markets, or that do both. Oftentimes, these are churches that are finding that they can use their resources of land and the people in their churches who can provide labor to be able to grow food and feed their community. The church that I work for, we bake bread and we sell it at farmers markets. This is our main form of outreach. This is how we get to know people in the community, and this is how people in the community get to hear a little bit more about what we are all about. In Grafton, we meet a lot of people at the Grafton Farmers Market who really have no desire to step foot back in a church. And a lot of them have been blown away by what we're doing by having a dinner. And they say, like, oh, I could come eat dinner. I don't think I could step back in a church, but I could come eat dinner with you. And these are folks who've become some of our most faithful members. But also, this process of hosting a farmer's market and of selling at a farmer's market is a way of subsidizing bread that we can then give away to those who are food insecure in our community. About 30% of our worshiping community is food insecure. Several of them have come to us at times when they had no idea what they would eat before. So it also becomes a way of making our church financially sustainable. It's hard to support a church when a third or more of your population is not able to give. And so by being at farmers markets, selling food, and showing them that we also have food to offer, we're letting people who don't have anything to give know that this is the place where they can come and receive, and they're not expected to give or offer anything more than their presence. And oftentimes they end up being people who come and help us bake, and they give their time, and they use their, they offer their physical labor because they know they can't offer anything financially. So, these are just a few different examples of ways that a theology of eating can be applied in community. I hope that these different food-centered ministries maybe spark some kind of creativity or imagination in your own mind for ways that you could employ them. But at the very least, I hope that you find God's creation of a tasteable world as absolutely marvelous as I do. And I hope that from now on you find yourself reflecting on the beauty of the gospel every time you sit down to eat. In the beginning, God, the great gardener, crafted life out of nothing. And God's greatest desire is to restore the universe into a heavenly banquet where we feast forever in the presence of God.
Kendall will stick around, and as is our custom here, if you need to go, you can head out quietly, but we will have a conversation, discuss whatever you want to talk about. You can ask specific questions, or I'll let Kendall kind of moderate our time of discussion.
Great. Yes.
Okay, well, thank you for giving us a tour of almost all of creation with respect to one aspect of it. All right, I have a real practical question just to understand how your background has affected how you see this. Mm-hmm. The practical question is, how much time have you spent on farms?
I have not spent significant time on farms. So this is kind of my, there's a large group of folks looking at food and theology, and most of them have a farming and gardening background. So that is not my background. I study cooking and eating together. So in the overview, it's kind of my area of least understanding. But they're the ones speaking into that side of things.
Okay, do I get a follow-up
question? Yeah, absolutely.
Who coined the word commensality?
That was coined by a man named George Simmel. So he was a sociologist of the 19th century, I believe. That's the first time I've seen it used in my research. It could have been coined before that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard it before.
Yeah, it's. I hadn't heard it before I started researching it, so.
Yeah, just along that line of commensality, I'm curious, what have you found within the social dynamics of eating together? What shifts or what changes in terms of, opening up conversations or just within the social dynamics of people, or especially with when diverse groups come together around the table versus in other settings?
Yeah, so the aspect that I really focused on in my own research was on the idea of comfort, and when we feel comfort, and if we feel comfort, how we're able to open ourselves up to others. So there are times when it is good and necessary for us to place ourselves into positions of discomfort, but the process of eating together creates a form of comfort or a way that our bodies know what to do. So, you know, if you're just sitting with someone, if we're just standing here having a really uncomfortable conversation, there's no physical barrier to block us, and our bodies don't have anything to do other than to see, like, what one another's bodies are doing, which is very uncomfortable. So when there's a table present and there's food present, our bodies automatically have a better understanding of what to do. And when our bodies are comfortable, then we're able to discuss other things. There's also the fact that we have a point of connection, something to talk about. So oftentimes, you know, people joke about, if you don't have anything to talk about, people talk about the weather. So George Simmel, who is kind of the main theorist that started the study of commensality, talks about how we need the lowest point, or the lowest common denominator, is what we look for to talk about. So the weather is a lowest common denominator because all of us feel it. But food is another one of those lowest common denominators. Everyone has an experience of food. So even if we're sitting around a table and have nothing else to talk about, we can talk about the food, and we can all have some kind of connection or experience with the food. And we're also all having the same physical experience. We're all tasting the same thing, and oftentimes eating from the same kind of communal bowl. So it is about comfort, I think, significantly. Yeah.
Wondering if you have any thoughts. I've heard a couple of people who struggle with food addiction,
mm-hmm.
whether it's with eating too much or with anorexia, just how difficult it is. Do you have any thoughts about how to be sensitive around that?
Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, again, one of the areas of brokenness is our relationship with our bodies, and that is a directly grown out of that. I think that's why I like to focus on looking at both sides of what it means, kind of the feasting and fasting together, of understanding both that our bodies were created for delight, and they were also created to function within the full dynamics of creation. So honoring God with our bodies is both delighting and also seeing limitations. But I think also in kind of this push to numbers and calculations, we lose sight of the enjoyment of well-made food. And I think it's that process of furthering that leads to people to have really, harmful relationships with their food. So as far as how to be sensitive in conversation, I am really a strong advocate to remove words like indulge or guilty pleasure out of our vocabulary. I think these are words that are really harmful in our understanding of food, and they move us away from understanding the way God desires for us to understand delight. So I think that those are two of the biggest issues. And also, a lot of our language about food and about shame around food is very gendered. So a lot of it, women are more likely to be seen as the ones indulging or having a guilty pleasure. And especially when it comes to rich food. So I think one step starting is to move out of that vocabulary more into a vocabulary of delight. And savor is another word that I think is a really helpful one to replace it with. We're savoring rather than indulging. Mary Frances.
Just to follow up on that, I think we obviously share a lot of meals around the table here at Liberty. And I grew up in the South. It has its own culture of food. And I have struggled with food about in ways over the years. Still do, but I think that just in a basic way, because we do have people that come to Liberty that struggle with food issues, sometimes we know it, sometimes we don't know it. I think even just basic things that I can't always do this, but I try to prepare food and put it on the table so that everyone can serve themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not putting food on people's plates for them. And also trying not to make any comments about, did you have enough? Are you sure you don't want more? Or, did you not like that? Or did you, just trying not to use that kind of language. Trying not to comment on people's activity at the table around the food. That if somebody has a plate of food and the meal is over and 95% of the food is on the table, it's not a topic for conversation. It just, the plate goes away with the rest of the plates. I've just, being at Liberty has just made me more sensitive to those types of things that are small, but also not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have a question?
I was wondering if you, in your research, in your study of the way that I like the word interdependence. The way that, and then the way that we're experiencing the brokenness of that interdependence, if you have given or heard, or what you've come across in regards to our relationships to animals. Well, disclosure, I am a vegetarian. But this is very fascinating to me because I think a lot of it, ethically speaking, our relationship to animals also influences our relationships. Relationship to the ground and to each other. And I was wondering if you had in your study, what you had heard or seen or anything like that.
Yeah. So there's a few different kind of main veins of thought in this. So someone like Norman Wiersbe is he kind of tries to break down the idea that consuming meat is harmful out of the idea that death is required, because death is always required for us to eat. So in that vein, there's the idea of it doesn't matter, because there's always a sense of death in the continuation of life. But then there's also just the side of our industrial system, the production of meat has ramifications outside of just an animal's death. It has the ramifications of the animal's livelihood itself. I think depending on who you talk to, there's people who sway both ways. In my program at BU, I would say about 75% of my classmates were vegetarian, which was really surprising to me because, as gastronomy, we're more focused on the culinary arts, and on the humanities, less focused on policy. And so I was surprised that people who are really focused kind of on this enjoyment of food, and on, could be seen as going more in the like gourmandise direction, were all vegetarians, and I expected that to be more the case among food policy people. So I think it really depends on who kind of in these conversations you talk to, but I would say most people are very much against the industrial meat system and are very thoughtful in the meat they consume. But, yeah, there's kind of everyone, I would say people are thoughtful about it, but not necessarily landing in the direction of vegetarian as the, like, broad theme in food and theology. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but, yeah. Yeah, Norman Mirza, in Food and Faith, he's got, I think, almost an entire chapter that talks about vegetarianism and meat consumption, and he's very hard on the meat system, but then also kind of weaves this theological, like, why meat's okay because people always die, or something always dies. So, yeah.
I just had a follow-up thought before when you talked about comfort in your other question. I had a friend that when her little girl would wake up in the night, she would give her, like, she would go in and sit with her and give her, like, crackers and juice, and they would talk about the Lord, and she'd have communion with her to give her comfort, and she'd use that, but it, so it was always, like, so every time that girl has communion anywhere, she connects that with this comforting reassurance that the Lord is with her, and she can go back to sleep. I always thought that was so beautiful, like, what a way to use it, you know? So it's a very simple, practical idea, but to use it with your children, like, as a connecting comfort, God, and safety, you know.
We have the church that I work at. Several families in the church have foster children, and so a lot of the families in our church talk a lot about kind of like body politics or the idea of like, what do you tell people, you know, if they're hugging you, you don't want to be hugged, or how do you tell people how they're not allowed to touch you? You know, you can't hold the kids on their hip for different reasons. And so the language they've used is like, if someone's doing something that they don't want, they say, this is my body. Like, you know, don't touch me, this is my body, I have control. And the language we use when we give communion is, this is my body. And so one of the little kids connected that with her dad when she was, he was tickling her or something, and she said, no, stop, Dad, this is my body, and does the motion of handing him the bread. But it was a connection of, like, yes, like, when we eat this body and blood, like, this is our safety and our comfort, and that should be what we see as our source of, you know, it should be always be seen as a source of safety and community. So, yeah, that's beautiful. Did you have another question?
Well, if you can indulge me in making a comment,
I would. Please do.
You touched upon the problems of famine in various places. And there is a great deal there, and I guess one part of the thing is that the world system is broken in many, many different ways.
Absolutely.
And yet, for instance, well, all right, so I can tell you the story that I learned from a man. His name is Jonathan Edwards. He is not the guy that was a great preacher years ago. He's actually now an assistant dean at Princeton University. But years and years ago, I shared an office with him when we were both doing a similar job. And so he and I, of course, talked about a lot of stuff. And he had done a PhD dissertation on Ethiopian economic history. So Ethiopia is a place where it is not known for having lots of food for everybody. But he says that his study of the place taught him that the famines and food distribution problems that they have there are directly a result of the lack of a system of law and order that they don't have there. They do not have economic justice. They do not have the rule of law. They do not have equal rights before the law. And so what happens in Ethiopia, and has happened for as long back as anybody knows, thousands of years probably, is that people who are out on the land as farmers are often assaulted by various other groups who come these days from the cities. And so the farmers have all learned, don't grow more than you need just for yourself. If you have an excess of food, any amount of excess, somebody else is going to come and take it from you. And so they consciously abstain from growing more food. Mm-hmm. And so you have an entire nation whose whole habit is to grow just barely enough in the good years. Mm-hmm. If they have a bad year weather-wise, they're really sunk. Mm-hmm. And so then they get into a famine situation. Mm-hmm. So they have these chronic famines in Ethiopia, but it comes from the lack of goodness in other parts of the society. So their food problems come from ethics problems. Basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an example of how interconnected all of the brokenness is. And I think also a good example of... because there is this like tendency to think that if we're reconnected with our food, then kind of these industrial food system issues will go away. And I think that's an example of like, no, the brokenness is so embedded in so many different aspects that it doesn't just, you know, reconnecting with the ground is not going to put everything back in place. So, yeah, thank you for sharing. Yeah.
You spoke a lot about returning to the gospel and restoration and all these relationships and delighting. And so I'm just wondering, also the quote about not just mere consumption or absorption, but appreciating. And so I'm wondering what you would say to the host of the meal / eating with together. How much power does that person have in creating or pointing each other to that delight? And does it go beyond, here's your meal, and that comfort you're talking about, but then they leave? And just wondering how much, you know.
Yeah, so I think the host has significant power over the dynamics of the meal. So, like, the word power can often be seen as a negative thing, but power is something that exists, and it can either be used for good or for evil, or just can remain neutral. So in the case of hosting a meal, the host has significant power over the dynamics of the meal. So Capone, in his book, writes a whole chapter on how the host, on why a cocktail party and mingling is the worst kind of party to throw, and why you should always have a dinner table with place settings. And he talks about like how you need to thoughtfully think about where everyone sits so that you can create these dynamics. So, I mean, he goes to an extreme. It's also written in the 60s, so a very different understanding of a dinner party. But I did a research project. So kind of the first research project I did before looking at food in church communities, I did a project where I brought together four different women who didn't know one another that I knew over the course of four meals to try and see together how basically we felt the formation of friendships over meals. So Heather was one of the four in that group. And what I found over the series of the meals is the meals where I, as the host, was not thoughtful in how the dynamics happened were the most awkward for everyone. And once I kind of facilitated things in a way that, like, people felt comfortable in my home, all of the dynamics shifted, and that's when the friendships really began to take off. So, yeah, I think it is, you know, if you're going to host, to think about, how are you providing food in a way that those who have a difficult relationship with food are comfortable or don't feel pointed out? Are you, setting people at a table in such a way that no one feels left out of conversation or unwelcomed in conversation? Or are you paying attention to who is feeling unwelcomed in conversation? I think that, like, that also extends to our understanding of, for me, the understanding of the Eucharist, right? So, like, in churches with a closed table, the priest has a lot of power over who eats and who doesn't. And, like, the priest is seen kind of as the one presiding. Jesus is the host, but the priest is presiding and kind of engaging those dynamics of how people interact. So, yeah, I think there's significant power, and that can be a thing that's used for good, and it can be a thing that's used badly. And when the host isn't intentionally using it for good, most likely it will veer in the direction of someone being unwelcomed or silenced.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sort of connected to this, in the churches that you've studied, or even mm-hmm. Simple Church, or Church of the Cross, mm-hmm. your experience of churches, yeah. how have you seen the community really establish Christ as the host of the meal? Or mm-hmm. or does that happen? Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
One of the churches that I find most fascinating is the Potluck Church in Kentucky that I talked about. So they actually set a space at the table for Jesus. So they put kind of a cross like in front of the plate. And the idea is that we need this visual reminder that Jesus is always present at our table. And also, it means we always have a space if someone comes in last minute. So, you know, we just take the cross away, someone sits there, and then, like, they can put it somewhere else. But so, that's, like, a very visual way of remembering that Jesus is present with us and dining with us and a part of a conversation. I think at Simple Church, you know, in that community, I think just actually, one thing we do is we use a giant loaf for communion. So I make the communion bread every week, and it's usually about 3 pounds of dough. So it's like this big. And we break it, and we serve it to one another. And then we take what's left over, and we put it at the tables, and that's the bread we eat with our meal. So it's also, like, not as much, like something we talk about, but it is another visual reminder of this bread that we just ate continues to nourish us throughout this whole meal, and Jesus is present. And we also, in our discussion questions, so the pastor will do the scripture reading, give a sermon, and then end with 3 discussion questions, and then we discuss. And at every discussion, like at the onset of every discussion, there's kind of the reminder of it's safe to disagree. Please disagree. You know, you all have opinions, and you're not going to have the same ones. So disagree and know that we're going to come back and have the wine together. So there's kind of that binding both sides with the body and the blood as kind of the reminder that this is what brings us all together. Yeah.
Question about maybe the way in which the Eucharist in the church can be, because it's supposed to be enacting our unity, mm-hmm. showing our unity, reminding us of our unity, both with Christ but with each other, horizontally. Mm-hmm. But just thinking about how the broader culture, and not just secular culture, but generally speaking, how food is so can be so divisive. Mm-hmm. Not just intentionally marginalizing someone or mm-hmm. creating hierarchies, our food choices become sort of this individualistic mm-hmm. part of who we are. No, I don't have this and this and this. And you think of I'm just trying to think of an example. There's many better examples, I'm sure. But from the movie, Julie and Julia, where she's at this table with 5 friends, and they all have this just radically precise, like, way they're ordering the Cobb salad. Mm-hmm. You know, like, no, I have it without this and with that. You know, like, and it's, they're sharing a meal together. And the kids have been eating at the same table, but they're all, they're not eating the same thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're not eating the same thing is part of their identity. You know, mm-hmm. you know, this is my food thing over here. This is mm-hmm. my, sometimes it's a legitimate allergy, sometimes mm-hmm. it's just extremely fine-tuned taste. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how some of the examples you've been talking about within the church mm-hmm. can be somehow an example of something different, basically, mm-hmm. of people actually coming together and by virtue of this, you know, the unity is demonstrated by we're eating the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. we are all equal members of this body. We're not a bunch of individualistic. People freaking out about our diets. You know, like I just that's the most helpful way to say it. But yeah. any thoughts on that, or just because I'd like to think that would be a welcoming picture.
Yes.
To somebody coming and saying, "Oh, these people." Yeah. Just all
Yeah. So one of the things that has been most humbling for me, I think, is in seeing people who use gluten-free bread and grape juice for communion. Mm-hmm. Because for me, like, I think the symbolism of the gluten itself in bread and the wine itself are so deeply meaningful. And so I think it's really sad when those get taken away from communion. But Garden Church, or several of these churches where there are significant numbers of either unhoused folks or folks that have had histories of addiction, purposely will only use grape juice because they want everyone to be drinking the same thing. And so actually, so Garden Church is Swedenborgian, and St. Lydia's in Brooklyn is Lutheran, and so both of them, like, their denominations say that it's not truly Eucharist without wine, and they've had to get special permission to use grape juice so that everyone is included in the same cup. And then they also, at Garden Church, they use gluten-free bread because the pastor herself is not able to have gluten. And so I think that's one sense where, like, they will acknowledge verbally the symbolic importance of gluten and of the, like, alcoholic fermentation of wine, but then they will step away from that for the sake of the full communion being able to eat the same thing.
Can you clarify what the symbolic significance of gluten is? I'm just curious.
Oh, that's a whole other conversation. But
Okay.
So I get very excited about this. Clearly, I have it tattooed on my arm. So gluten is made up of two proteins, two amino acids, glutenin and gliadin. One of them provides structure, and the other provides flexibility. So either one of them on their own, so I always forget which is which, but the one that provides flexibility, if it didn't have the other, it would just spread, and then one of them, it would just remain stiff. So it's called the interaction of the plastic and elastic. So as gluten develops, they interweave together to create a net, and then when they weave this net, as the sugar and the starches in the wheat ferment, then it, like, breathes it with life, and it's what brings it back to life and gives it the structure and allows it to be the bread that it is. So that's just, like, one small piece of the significance, and for me that's especially significant because I kind of exist, and my research exists in between very vastly different sides of Christian community. So I went to Wheaton College for my undergrad, and most of my colleagues and I work now are Harvard Divinity graduate students, or graduates, and if you know anything about those two schools, they have very, very different languages of Christianity. And so understanding that, you know, as they exist in tension with one another, it has, for me, opened up to this really beautiful understanding of God, and that neither side can really exist without the other, even if they, like, really don't like other aspects, and they both have sides that they really do badly, and they both have things they do well, and together there's this tension of plastic and the elastic, and it grows.
Is there any other grain that does the same thing?
Gluten is the only one. Yeah. So, I mean, wheat is the main one, but barley and oats both have gluten as well but there's, with wheat, there's also the fact that, wheat's a grass. In order for wheat to be harvested, it has to die. So wheat is, you know, it's alive and then it dies. It's harvested, it's ground into flour. When that flour is mixed with water, the yeast that still live on it come back to life. And as it comes back to life, then you mix it together, and it goes through this kneading process, and this life grows as the tension builds together, and then that bread has to die in order for it to become bread, and that bread has been the basis of food for human civilization since it's kind of the first food. It was the domestication of wheat that was the first kind of or at least this is what we bakers say. Maybe those who have more farming history know a different story. But that it was the domestication of wheat that led to the building of agriculture, and then it was the domestication of agriculture that allowed kind of society, like a non-nomadic society, to build at all. So kind of wheat and bread and the gluten in it are kind of have been structurally like part of human civilization for all of history. So,
I had this note when he said about not being so fastidious in what you order.
My daughter did a paper in college about gluttony. And she said being fastidious about what you don't eat, like the flip side, it's the same thing as gluttony because you're so specific about your own needs that you're not, which was, I thought was interesting. That reminded me of that. Like, by not eating, it's being gluttonous.
Yeah, and I think it's, like, again, it's this, like, very independent, this side of, like, it's about me and my experience, less than, like, this interdependent experience. Yeah.
I'm just on that.
Yeah.
Have you found helpful ways to talk about that with people? I think it's challenging. And, I mean, I think food allergies are one thing, but I think, you know, the rampant individualism in our culture has woven itself into, we eat alone, not only do we physically eat alone, but, you know, it's this, like, I eat exactly how I want to eat, and I'm making a choice to not eat fill in the blank, a variety of things, or things like a paleo diet or this kind of diet, or doing the Mediterranean diet, or this is how I eat. It's a struggle when you're trying to bring everyone together at the table. And I appreciate what you said about, and what Ben was talking about, this idea that, like, we're all eating the same thing. We struggle with it a lot here to know how to hold that. Do you have any? The idea of sort of restaurant, we live in restaurant culture where we're used to food being something, the commodity, you know, it's like I pay money, so I get exactly, I get the meat cooked how I want, I get this without this or whatever.
Yeah.
And just that mindset that people sometimes aren't even aware that they have. Being a very different thing of being, I mean, even forget the Eucharist. I mean, just being around the dinner table together in one place and hospitality. I don't know if you have any wise words.
Yeah, it's something that we have struggled with at Simple Church, knowing how to address, because for the first, like, 2.5 years that we were in existence, there was no one who was gluten-free. So we didn't really have to question, like, you know, bread is so central to this whole church model. Like, what would we do if someone couldn't eat the bread? And we now have one member who's gluten-free, but it's actually not an allergy. It's because his wife is allergic, and so he remains gluten-free in solidarity with her, but she doesn't attend the church. So it's kind of a, like, another odd dynamic of, like, what do we do in this case? Which he does not take communion for personal reasons, and so we've kind of been able to not have to broach that yet with our bread. And then we do in our, like, everything else that we serve, we make sure to keep it gluten-free. So I think in that context, like, the big circle and the smaller circles are, like, visually really important spaces to show, like, one unites us, and there's some things we're not going to bend on, and then we can break into smaller ones where we can disagree. And so, like, you know, right now, because of the makeup of that community, that's how we address it, but that would have to change if someone came who was allergic to wheat and wanted to take part in communion. So, it's a tricky one, and... No, I don't have answers.
Yeah, I'm just pushing, and it's hard to know how you push people a bit to even consider, like, make a choice to step away from this for the sake of the togetherness, the experience at the table.
Yeah. There's a new, like, so one of the kind of facets of this, like, food studies field is called critical nutrition studies, and it's taking, like, nutritional science, but understanding it through, like, an anthropology lens. So rather than just looking at kind of the science of nutritional science, looking at kind of the different social dynamics that have led to different nutritional theories, and who they benefit and how, kind of what other factors might interpret nutritional science. So I think that's kind of a field that is, like, beginning to grow that will hopefully kind of help to start some better conversations about, like, our cultural experience is very much affects our physical experience. And so, like, people do experience physically, things that might not have, like, a direct, you know, like, our mind is really powerful. So I'm not sure, like, right now I'm not equipped to have those conversations, but there are some people who are trying to help equip people to have those conversations. So for right now, yeah. Yeah.
How do you, that was great, first of all. Oh, yeah. It's off to you. I really enjoyed every part of that presentation. Is it recorded? Are we going to be able to
Yes, it is recorded. Yes.
So I'm wondering, as far as brokenness is concerned, I think as Christians, it's we can appreciate and understand what it means to have a fallen nature that's been redeemed by Christ. But how do you then convey this message to an unbeliever? Mm-hmm. And then also, what happens in terms of brokenness and allergies? So mm-hmm. not having gluten mm-hmm. and enjoying the body of Christ, the mm-hmm. bread, how do you connect brokenness to allergies that we mm-hmm. are experiencing more and more? It seems to be an exponential mm-hmm. situation as mm-hmm. we continue to society. So what do you think is going on? Mm-hmm.
So in relation to the allergies and brokenness, I think this is another example of... even as we try and fix issues, this brokenness still continues and manifests itself in different and in new ways. And so we do have to be aware of and respond to the new different dynamics of brokenness that exist. I think saying that this is another, just yet another example of brokenness. But also food still remains the good thing that God created it to be. So, you know, we still need to understand, like, despite this allergy, can we look back to food as, like, a source of healing? Or can we look back to the way we're producing food and if there's anything else that's, you know, causing these allergies? I think learning how to address the very real fact that they exist, which is what we're still trying to do, but also seeing that, like, they exist, and it's a part of our brokenness, but that doesn't keep our eating together from being good, you know, what God desired it to be. And what was the first part of that question? I
forgot. Just sharing this message.
Oh, yes, sharing the message. So I've actually been really amazed to find that by studying dinner church communities, I have had way more fruitful conversations with my non-Christian friends than I've ever been able to have before, because I've worked in the restaurant industry in some capacity since I was 16, and so the restaurant industry is a, I don't know if any of you have any experience in it, but it's a really eclectic collection of individuals. Oftentimes folks who have, like, all different kinds of crazy backgrounds, and so yeah, I know a lot of people who have felt, or who have been outright rejected by the church in different ways, and people who are deeply wounded by their experiences in the church. And so I've always felt very nervous to tell people what I do, to be like, I study churches and I'm going to seminary, because for most of them, like, they're in the restaurant industry because they feel unwelcomed kind of anywhere else. But in my food studies courses, I was shocked to find that in every single class we were talking about the Eucharist, because the Eucharist is so fascinating and weird to food studies scholars from everywhere. If we didn't talk about the Eucharist, we talked about the Levitical food laws. Like, people were always fascinated by, like, what is this obsession with food and how we eat? And so when I started telling people, like, oh, here's churches that worship around food, they were so fascinated to hear about the process of eating, and I can't tell you the number of people who have said, like, I never thought I would step into a church, but if my church were like that, I would go. Or who have said, like, I would come to a church if we were eating together. And so I think actually, like, I think that this, like, narrative of brokenness is a way that we see, or this narrative of food and understanding this brokenness is, I think, a way of understanding, like, how the world is operating and how God has been interacting with the world throughout all of creation. But people don't have to understand that to understand God. I think instead it's just evidence that food is deeply a way that we understand God. And so when people experience food and experience worship through eating, they're able to connect with God in this way that almost like overrides the painful experiences that they've had, because they have such good experiences of food. And so then when they pair these good experiences of food with worship, rather than these really painful experiences they've had in church, then it gives them the space to rethink who God is and how God interacts with them and what church community can be. Yes.
I, at the risk of saying too much here.
It's okay. Go for it.
So, certainly, okay, one side of food consumption, mm-hmm. which you did touch on, is the issue of fasting. Mm-hmm. And a couple of months here, there was a whole discussion about fasting. Mm-hmm. And that was worth talking about. But I guess one thing that you are getting to thinking about here is the issue that sometimes God wants us to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Old Testament, we often find various festivals.
Mm-hmm.
There can be both festivals and fasts.
Mm-hmm.
But God, in the Old Testament and in Deuteronomy and many places, says, okay, here's a special occasion, and to do this thing right, you should get special food. You should have mm-hmm. choice morsels, mm-hmm. the things that you like to eat best, and mm-hmm. you will have these as you celebrate this great festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many people don't realize how many of these there were
mm-hmm.
in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
That there are definitely occasions where God says, here, eat, do it,
mm-hmm.
and commands us to enjoy ourselves by eating.
Yeah.
And I think that dropped out of theological understanding,
mm-hmm.
You know, when people weren't reading the Old Testament enough, maybe, I don't know. or not looking in those unlikely seeming parts of it, but
mm-hmm.
they're there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I risked something there, did I?
No. I mean, I think that's great. So, again, like I said, I'm Anglican, and I really love just the Anglican kind of order of worship, because we follow this liturgical calendar where we have periods of feasting and periods of fasting, and we see that, like, to understand the fullness of, you know, our communion with God, it requires going in cycles. And these cycles of feasting, and these cycles of fasting, and these cycles of celebration, and different kinds of celebration, and so I think that, you know, we see that in the Old Testament as well, of like celebration and reserving foods just for celebration, or bringing out the special foods just for celebration, is a way that we understand God more deeply, and when that's paired with fasting or paired with seasons of restriction, then it helps us to understand the abundance all the more. So. I think that also it's lost significantly in just, like, our very Gnostic understandings of our bodies. I think that Christianity in the West tends to be really scared of our bodies, or talking about our bodies, or understanding that we, or just talking about the fact that we know God through our physical experience. And so seeing food as this deeply spiritual thing, or seeing eating and feasting as a deeply spiritual thing, is scary to people who are scared of bodies or material things.
Well, maybe that comes from reading the Bible less and reading Aristotle too much or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's not new, right? It's something that's been in existence, you know,
certainly the ancient pagans wished to, well, some groups of them wished to de-emphasize it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's taken different forms, you know, all throughout history. But yeah, it's definitely, I think, something that keeps us from appreciating feasting significantly, which I think is really sad. So, yeah. Did you have a question? Oh, sorry, I thought you saw your hand. Never mind. Sorry to point you out. Yes?
Really simple questions. How long have you been baking bread?
Ooh, so I've been baking bread, like really trying to understand bread for the last 6 years. But I've been baking since I was little. I don't know, since I was like 12.
Have you created your own, like, recipes, or do you have certain recipes that you make for the Lord's Supper at your church? Or do you make something different every week? Or, like, mm-hmm. do you do the same thing? Like, how do you, like,
Yeah.
What do you actually make?
Yeah, so at Simple Church, we have just one dough that we use for everything that we sell. So it's a long fermentation dough in a similar method to sourdough, but we use commercial yeast. So it's like an 18-hour process, similar to no-knead bread, if you guys are familiar with that. So that's what I use for them, and then we mix in different kinds of, for selling, we mix in like roasted garlic or cinnamon or such. For communion, I like to do different things. So I am a huge proponent of having leavened bread as communion. I think like there's spiritual importance in having leavening rather than unleavened bread, which is a theme that I'm not totally versed on yet, but plan to explore more when I have better theological guidance. So I always make a leavened bread of some kind, usually an enriched bread, which means it has like sugar or eggs or butter, which I see as just a sign of like celebration. And I try to experiment with shapes. Like I don't ever do just a simple round loaf. I think it should be festal, should always be something celebratory. But I experiment. I play around with it all the time. I've definitely had ones that are total flops. Like, I get there, and it doesn't raise at all, and it's just what we eat it, always. Yeah. No one else seems to, like, be as particular as I do, so, yeah. Yeah?
I was just going to, in regard to Richard's question about fast, like, feasting and fasting, I did a lecture last time on Sabbath, I'm not officially practiced in practicing Sabbath in an intentional way, but one of the things that I came across was the use of food and celebratory food to celebrate the Sabbath. But I think one of the things that's interesting when we think about feasting, that I can't remember now which book it was I read, but especially in America, we essentially feast all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can get our hands on, I mean, we can eat raspberries in the middle of the winter. Mm-hmm. We can get our hands on anything. Mm-hmm. And so we can eat whatever we feel like eating just with a quick trip to the grocery store. So mm-hmm. for most people who have a car and the financial means, mm-hmm. And we, you know, you go to restaurants and the servings are huge. And you know, all of these things that we actually live in a feasting culture.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of intentional fast, intentional mm-hmm. feast, is just more foreign to us. And one of the, oh, I know what the book is, The Rest of God by Mark Buchanan. Mm-hmm. He talks about entering a season of very, very intentionally celebrating Sabbath in his life. And so he actually intentionally scaled back on the type and the amount of food he ate during the week so that he could have food be an area of feast for him on Sundays, because he recognized that just in the ways he was just eating normally, and it's not like he had like filet mignon for dinner every night, but you know, like a huge bowl of cereal and eggs and for breakfast. And so he intentionally scaled back. And I know that the priest at the Episcopal Church in town, I don't know if he does this every year, but I've heard him during Lent talk about he does a fast kind of all week. So he's eating, but he's reading really basic and minimal things during the week. And he actually takes the money that they save on their groceries and he gives it to a food group. But then on Sunday, he's feasting. And I just kind of thought about it in that framework before. That that's obviously not going to be the case for every person in every part of the world, but certainly for the average American person, we're in feast mode all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, again, this book, Supper of the Lamb, I really can't recommend it enough. It's so hilarious and entertaining and just really thoughtful as well. But he has kind of his whole chapter on feasting and fasting. It's basically his response to dieting. So, obviously dieting is something that's very, it is very specific to cultures who have the ability to feast all the time. With that comes then the desire to diet. And so, his kind of response is that getting into cycles of feasting and fasting instead of the idea of dieting will reconnect us with what food is supposed to be. Yeah.
I think to me, also in response to the question about eating disorders and the complicated relationship so many people have with food that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the sadness of the fact that food is sort of viewed as an enemy instead of what it's supposed to be, what nourishes us. And, I wonder whether it's analogous in some ways to the way in which a concept of fatherhood has to be redeemed for people to relate to God as father. A theology of food, he needs to be redeemed for people to actually really, or just a new relationship to food has to be somehow come about for people to embrace the Christian theology of food. How do you convince somebody that this is, that feasting with God forever in heaven is going to be a really good thing? You know, if the associations are so twisted, you know, I don't know.
I keep thinking of the film Babette's Feast, and you know, like talk about a depiction of a Gnostic relationship to the body and to enjoyment and to food. And I'm always just so taken by the role that the general, you know, the man who has been to the top of society, the role that he plays in this meal with people who just have no clue what they're putting in their mouths. And the interpretive role that he plays for them to begin to enjoy something that they're so distanced from because of their... because of their theology, because of their habit, because of their fear. And anyway, I don't know where I'm going with that, except like that it would be a significant thing, I guess, to become interpreters at meals, you know, in the same way that... And I thought of that when you were talking about the good power of a host at a meal, you know, to be someone that is interpreting... for people, what they're experiencing, so that they have a new way to it.
It reminds me a little bit of this. We had a couple of helpers here a number of years ago who were both very, very good cooks, and they, one of them had worked in restaurants for many years, and they just for fun, they would make things on their day off. You know, it's, anyway, there's just an incredible standard at the time they were here. It was intimidating. they were kind of getting fed up with a particular group of students here at the time. They would just scarf their food down and not really attend to what they were doing. They were making it impossible to appreciate the care with which these things were made. And I think at some point they had a conversation with all the students that, like, you have to eat some. Basically, like, this is kind of what you're talking about as an interpreter. Like, you need to slow down enough so that you notice anything.
My mother used to say to me, would you please taste it? Dude, it tastes good. You want more?
An old roommate of mine just got married a month ago, and her husband is a biochemist at MIT, and so he's in the lab all the time, and he became really intrigued with Soylent. Are you guys familiar with Soylent? Okay, so for those of you who aren't familiar, it's basically supposed to be like the entire meal replacer. It's this like sludgy color. I haven't tasted it, but I have heard other people describe the taste, and it doesn't sound pleasant. And so he bought a can of it just to try, and he like brings it in the house, and she told him, she's like, that's not allowed in our home. Like, you're not allowed to bring that into our house. And not just because of the idea that it's disgusting, but like, she was like, no, I have a theological problem with you bringing that into our home. Like, you will not drink your meals. We will sit and we will enjoy them and we will eat them together. So, it's not all in their home. I know. It's still in his lab, and I still, like, give him a hard time every time. Exactly.
That's a couple of Ben's thing, too. I just find that when you really stop and relish a meal, that idea of, like, reveling and enjoying food instead of, like, this indulgent language, it really just restores a sense of gratitude for the vision as well. And it was a bit ironic, actually, after writing that gluttony paper, I kind of realized I had fallen into this habit of multitasking over meals, because as a college student, I was like, those midterms are coming up, you know, like, I got to study and whatever, so I would, like, read a textbook, or I'd be teaching a paper, or I'd be, you know, officially in contact with other people, messaging and emailing or whatever, during my lunches, especially, and I just, actually really faced a conviction about that. Like, if I slow down and I take this time, like, set apart in the center of the day, almost paralleling the sort of Jewish habit of midday prayer, and really just dwell in thankfulness, like, the posture of thankfulness is more important than just saying a quick grace before I dig in, you know? And so I really enjoy this idea of, like, dwelling on food together, because it creates that active posture of thankfulness internally as well as externally. I think that can really help us slow down and remember the art of Sabbath in such a busy and fast-paced and, like, task-oriented kind of culture. So when we view food as, like, a delight instead of a task to be accomplished, I think that's a really rich way to remember me and the gratitude that we belong to.
So Norman Wiersbe, I quote this to everyone all the time, so if you know me, you've probably heard me say it before. But he writes about Sabbath, and he says that Sabbath is not a reprieve from life, but a putting to an end of the restlessness that prevents deep engagement with it. And that, obviously, I haven't memorized. It like completely changed my understanding of Sabbath and of rest and of food. But of, you know, I think we tend to view Sabbath as this time where, like, God asks us to slow down so that, like, then we can continue on for the other 6 days of work. But he parallels it to, like, God spent 6 days creating, and then the seventh day he just spent delighting in the creation that he just made. And so when we Sabbath, it's not this time to rest so we can go back to work, but it's a time to just sit and delight in and dwell in the work that we've been doing. And then work becomes this really beautiful thing, and then also the delight of that work becomes this beautiful thing, and, like, totally restructures, you know, our understanding. So I try and think through, like, you know, how can I carry this into every day? Like, it's not just Sabbath, then, doesn't just become about Sunday or the time of rest. It becomes about our mindset all week around rest and restlessness.
Kendall, I'm mindful that you have a drive. And I think you can tell your passion has been contagious.
So, I'm glad.
Unless there's another burning question, I want to let you go
free. Thank you very much.
I am a big fan of social media, especially Twitter. Some really great food conversations. So if you are on Twitter and you want to continue the conversation, then I'll happily converse and show you other people who would love to converse as well. So I think my Twitter handle's on the handout that you should have got.